So Stefan pointed out that in my at the end of the proof, one of the soup should be inf, which explain why I screw it up at the end. So let me correct that and we move on. Yeah. So I share my screen. Can you see the file?
Yes, everything is visible. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I was taking the soup of the integral of phi m plus psi m prime. Okay, and I was taking it under this condition, which must hold for any x and y. So of course, if I fix phi, the best choice for psi should be the infimum of x of this quantity, not the supremum. So this soup here should be an inf, in fact, which explain why I was a little bit bothered before. Okay, so if I take the inf, so this shows exactly as before that psi star must be one Lipschitz, and if you do the same argument, this tells us that phi also must be one Lipschitz. Okay, but now if phi is one Lipschitz, then the best you can take is y x is x equal y, which gives you psi star must be equal to minus phi of y. Okay, so the proof actually is complete here. Okay, the only point where I cheated in the proof was in the assumption that we could use Sion's min-max theorem, which is not completely true in this setting. So you have to show that you can restrict the probability measure P to probability measure the measure P to measure which have some bounded moment. Okay, so some bounded mass, sorry, and this makes you compact. Okay, so but I won't explain that; it would take a little bit too long. Okay, so now we go to the second part of this course, which is the notion of differentiability in the space of measures. So we're going to do a little bit of differential calculus. So let's write it differential calculus. And from now on, I'm going to work in P2, so P equal 2, and I'm going to work in RD for some, where D is not a positive integer. Okay, so I will write most often P2 as P2 of RD. Okay, so what I want to do is to investigate what kind of derivative we can introduce in this space. So the difficulty is, of course, the fact that P2 is not a vector space. And you cannot talk about Fréchet derivatives and so on. So it's a little bit strange to want to do that, but somehow we will need this kind of derivative in order to define some differential equation in the space of probability measure at the end of the course. Okay, so the way we are going to proceed is a little bit naive. Is to point out that P2 is a convex space, okay? So I remind you that P2 is a set of probability measure with second order moment finite. Okay, so it's a convex space, and somehow in convex space you can do some motion, okay? And some linear motion, and the starting point of our calculus will be this kind of linear derivative. So we are going to call them L2 derivative. It's a very naive way, and it doesn't work very well. So, and in practice, to be useful, we will be obliged to modify it a little bit and to find what we will call intrinsic derivative. So on all these parts, the standard reference is the first book by Carmona and Delargue on probabilistic aspect of mean field gain. Also, I won't completely follow their approach. I will use mostly the idea developed in this first part of the book. So what we'll call the L2 derivative . So the idea is the following. So you consider a function that I will most of the time denote by capital U, a function from P2 to R. And it's a continuous function. And I'm going to talk about C1 functions, okay, instead of derivatives, pure derivatives. It would be more convenient for in the second. There is a notion of derivative, differential, if you want, okay? But the theory is much more involved, and so let me talk about C1 instead of differentiable, okay? So we say that U has a as an L2 derivative. So it's in fact, I should say C1 in the L2 sense. If there exists a continuous unbounded map, okay, so the space P2 is an infinite dimensional vector space. So it's it's a kind of a functional space. Okay, so it's not a surprise that the derivative should be also a functional. Okay, so this derivative that we'll denote by delta U over delta M goes from P2, so P2 is a base space, okay, time RD. And it goes to R. And which is such that you have the equality that somehow U of M minus U of M prime, U of M prime minus U of M. So I'm considering this difference, and I'm going to say that the difference of the function U at two different points, M prime and M, is just the integral of the derivative. Okay, so it's the integral between 0 and 1. And the integral of RD delta U over delta M. So I'm taking, so I'm using the fact that P2 is a linear space, it's a convex space, okay? So by taking the convex envelope of N and N prime. So remember that delta U over delta M is a function which depends on the measure and on an extra point, okay? And this extra point is integrated against M prime minus M. Okay, so this is a definition of the derivative. It's not perfect at all because, for instance, m prime minus m integrated against constant is zero, which means that this quantity is not unique. It's unique up to a function depending only on m. Okay, so usually there is a convention to fix that. I won't use it here, but there is a warning, which is that this function is defined up to a function depending on m. Okay, only. Okay, not on y. So let me give you examples to show you. Anyway, we won't use much this derivative. We use the intrinsic derivative, which will appear in a moment, and which will be the correct derivative. But first example to show you how it works. So the first one is what happened to a linear function. And so I forgot to say that, of course, this must hold for any measure. So assume that u of m is just linear in the sense that it's integral over Rd of phi of x, m of dx.
So the integral over dt is missing in the
definition. And the integral over dt is missing, thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, so coming back to my example, if you define u of m as the integral of some function phi, which is continuous and bounded in Rd, then clearly, I don't know if you see it, but to match this definition, it's pretty clear that the derivative must be phi. Again, up to a function depending on m only, okay? You just plug this expression into here and you see that it matches. Okay, that's almost transparent. So let me look at another example. So so now let me take something a bit more a little bit less linear. What is less than linear, it's quadratic. Okay, so let me take something which is quadratic. So you see that this is quadratic in terms of m and m, in terms of m. Okay, now phi must be a function on the Rd times Rd, and it must be continuous and bounded. Okay, and in this case, we realize relatively easily, so this is an exercise, that delta u or delta m of m y must be equal to, well, I don't know if you see it, so it must be the integral over Rd of phi of x y m of dx. Sorry, I'm going to write it in a single line. Okay, so it's quadratic, so there must be two terms, which is natural, plus phi of yx that you integrate against m of x. Okay, so you can look at that as an exercise. Okay, so you see that, okay, so I won't insist on that, but there is a beautiful theory. So you can see that the first example is something which is linear, second example is something which is quadratic, and of course you could define functions which are cubic in M, quadratic in M, and so on. So this looks very much like polynomial, okay? And there is a beautiful remark by Lyons, which says that, in fact, these polynomial functions are somehow dense in the set of continuous maps on P2 of Hertz. Okay, so and you can play with that to prove some results like the Evitz-Savage theorem, something like that. Okay, so you have kind of notion of polynomial on the set P2 of Hertz. Okay, but okay, so. As I said before, this notion is not completely very sort of satisfactory. First, because it's not uniquely defined, okay, and second, because it has no intrinsic explanation. Okay, so let me move on to show you something which is more natural. So I'm going to define it a little bit axiomatically and then explain you why it is interesting and it's a correct definition. So if you have a question on this derivative, please do ask it and then we move on.
Is that that you think about the mean value theorem and the Taylor formula, so the, in a way that you copy this idea to get this gradient definition? If you consider this as a scalar product, M prime minus M.
It's a kind of, so we call it L2 because we do as if the space P2 was a kind of linear space. Was a kind of linear space. This is what your question? Yeah, this is the mean value theorem, okay, more or less.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. But again, he doesn't see the, so the point, what is missing here is to see the geometry, the natural geometry of the space P2. And so I will comment on that in a moment. So moving linearly in the space P2, so as a convex space, is not the most natural motion you can do. And in particular, you don't, okay. I'll come back on that when I state the main result on the correct derivative, which is the intrinsic derivative.
Yeah, thank you.
So if you don't have a question, let me move now to the correct notion of the correct definition. So I'm going to introduce it in a very strange way. And then I'll give the main theorem. So this is called the intrinsic derivative. So again, I take a function defined on the space of probability measures. And we assume that it has an L2 derivative. So I'm assuming that this function has an L2 derivative, which has a little more regularity. So I'm assuming that this function is C1 with respect to the second order variable. So. Okay, so. With respect to the second order variable, okay, du over dm is a map going from Rd to R, okay, and I'm assuming that its gradient is continuous. in all variables. So dy. So the y is the second variable of this function. Okay. And I'm assuming that it globally continues. And bounded.
Do you mean dy of u or dy of the differential order?
I mean dy of the difference of the L2 derivative.
Oh, that means that you take this L2 derivative and then you just take the second variable. You don't differentiate once more this.
No. I don't differentiate once more with respect to M. I differentiate this intrinsic derivative with respect to the extra variable which appears here.
Okay, you differentiate this one already with respect to y.
Okay, I'll give you an example in a moment. Yeah. Okay. So, and I'm assuming that this is continuous and bounded to fix the LDs. Okay. Then the intrinsic derivative is precisely this object. Okay. So it's a little bit weird to differentiate twice the function. Okay, but this is the correct object as we will see in a moment. So it's precisely this object. So it's called dm of u. So it's defined at a point, base point m, which is a measure, and at a point y, which is an element of Rd. And this is the gradient. So I'm calling this is the gradient. Y dm of u. Okay, so this is the intrinsic derivative, okay? So let me come back to the example I gave before, and then I will justify why this is the correct definition. So in the first case, so remember in the linear case, we found that the linear derivative was just phi, okay? And so the intrinsic derivative must be the gradient of the derivative, the linear derivative, so the L2 derivative. So it must be the gradient of phi. So in fact, phi must be C1 and bounded. With a bounded derivative. Okay. So the condition that this is bounded is just for. To simplify the discussion, in the Carmona de la Rue book, you will find extension of this condition, but it won't be important in what we are doing. Okay, so you see here it's very simple, but you see that it's weird that the derivative should be the derivative with respect to the measure of the function u should be the derivative of phi respect to the gradient of phi. Okay, and we will see that it makes completely sense just in a moment. And in the second example, you have the same kind of remark. So if u of m is a double integral, then you can see that it's exactly in the same way. The derivative of m of u should be the integral of D of the derivative respect to the first variable of phi of x, y. And the derivative, so be careful. Okay, so let me write d1 for the derivative respect to the first variable and d2 for the derivative respect to the second variable, because I'm obliged to exchange the place of the variable. Okay, so d1 is the gradient of phi respect to the first variable, and d2 is the gradient of phi respect to the second variable. And it's m of dx. Okay. Okay, now let me, so I let you think about it a little bit, but what I want to do now is to justify this introduction by showing you that it has to do with the structure, the geometry of RD, in fact, okay? And the way one moves in RD, the way one moves in RD. So you saw that in the, in the linear derivative, one makes interpolation, linear interpolation between the two measures, okay? And we don't see at all this could hold this could be defined for metric space. We don't move at all in the space direction, okay? So we will see that here we take into account the fact that one moves in the space direction, and in particular, this kind of notion of derivative would work on a manifold and so on. Okay, so let me show you how one can move in the space P2 by a vector field. So let phi from RD to RD be a vector field. And I'm assuming it's bounded. Sorry, I'm saying something stupid. Okay, let's assume it's bounded for simplicity. So it's Borel measurable. So I'm going to do for what I'm going to do, bounded is not enough. So sorry, I have to replace this with a linear course. So what I mean is that capital phi of x in norm is less than some constant times the length of x plus one. Okay. So and one way to move in the RD space it's to take x and to associate it phi of x. Okay, so it's a motion. So let me introduce the notation. If you take M in P2F RD, then it's easy to see that what I'm going to denote by phi push forward by M. So this is the image of M by phi that I will define in the next line. So what I'm claiming is that this definition give me an element of P2 of RD. And by definition, this object, okay, this is the image of M by Fi. Okay, sorry about the notation. There are plenty of ways to to denote that, and I'm sure that Stefan has another in probability. Usually, it's not used like that. But, okay. So this object is defined by for any test function small phi. This is just the integral of the axis. So careful, capital phi is given here, and small phi is a test function. So because capital phi has a linear growth, so it's easy to see that this gives you a Borel probability measure, okay, and it has a second order moment which is finite because phi has a linear growth. Okay, so okay, I don't know, Stefan, how you write this kind of object down, this kind of image.
Sometimes just with the circle or with a little.
Yeah, okay. So there are plenty of notation. So here I'm using the notation that people in optimal transport are using. So they always use that.
So Tapio should say this, yes or no?
Okay, so. So what I'm going to say now is the first step, one of the explanation of this intersect derivative, which is a Fourier proposition. So assume that U has an intrinsic derivative. Then when one moves the probability measure M in a small direction, like phi, okay, you can write that in terms of intrinsic derivatives. So in other words, the limit as h goes to zero of u. So I want to make a small motion. Okay, so and phi is as a bow. Okay, so I take the identity of RD. Okay, id is the identity of RD, so the map which to X associates X, and I make a small motion in the direction of phi. So I move slightly the measure M in the direction of phi. Okay. And this quantity is just the integral of the RT. Of the intrinsic derivative of U integrated against phi of y, m of dy. Okay, so when you move a little bit in the direction phi, okay, this quantity, what you get is the intrinsic derivative. Okay, so as a consequence, in fact, so I said that phi was a vector field. Now, if you move your m along a differential equation, okay, you see that the derivative is given by this kind of quantity. Okay, so when phi is the vector field of the differential equation. So this is a way to move measures in a geometric way in the space in a geometric way. So using the fact that here we are in RD, so we can do motion along vector fields and so on. I don't know if you have questions.
Could you also start with this proposition as a definition, or is this too general?
No, you could start with this definition also, yes, that's correct. Yeah, yeah. This could be a definition. It must be a linear object with respect to phi. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to do the proof, and then tomorrow I will come back with this property. So I'll finish with this proof, and you will see it's relatively easy. And today, tomorrow I will come back with other reasons why it's interesting to do that. So to be complete, okay. So let's do a sketch of proof. Okay, so I want to look at that. So what we know is the fact that you have, so by definition of the flat derivative, we know that you evaluated at this measure. Minus u evaluated at m. Okay, I'm just using the definition of the flat derivative. Okay, so this is equal to the integral between 0 and 1. So the integral over Rd of the flat derivative, the L2 derivative of mth. So this plays basically no role. So I'm going to explain it in a moment. And this is evaluated as a difference between the two measures. Okay, and this one is transparent. It's a linear interpolation. I always forget dt. This linear interpolation between this measure and this measure, when h is small, it's very, very close to m. Okay, so it's almost equal to m. Okay, now let me rewrite this quantity. So this is integral between 0 and 1, the integral over Rd of delta u over delta m evaluated at m of th. And here I use the definition of that object. Okay, so I'm splitting the integral in two parts. Okay, the integral against that and the integral against that. Okay, so what I get is that here I've got this operator applied to y, so it's y plus h phi of y that I must integrate against n. Okay. So since the other part, I must also integrate against m, let me put it right now. Okay. And now you see that what appears here naturally is the derivative in space of that object. Okay. So as n of th is very close to m, okay, this is more or less equal, this is very close to the integral between 0 and 1, the integral of Rd of the derivative with respect to the extra variable of delta u of delta m. Of m, y, scalar product with phi of y, m of dy, plus a small over h, small. Okay. So I just use the dimension. So it's completely transparent, okay, but it shows you that this is the correct object if you want to do translation in the space. If you do, if you want to move in the space of RD with respect to vector field. Okay, let me adopt now another point of view, which is a projection over the projection of a finite dimensional space. So we have seen yesterday that when we look at function depending on a lot of variables, when they are symmetric enough, then what is at the limit is a function defined on space of measure. So I'm going to go in the other direction to take a function defined on the space of measure and to project it in finite dimensional space and to see what is what becomes the derivative there in this space. So, we will see this quite often because it's very useful. So I take a function defined on the space of quality measure. And I fix an integral n, non-zero. And I define un, which is defined on Rd, so the base space, to the power n. So I have the map which takes x1, xn all in Rd and associate u of the empirical measure associated with x. So remind you that this empirical measure it's just 1 over n, the sum of the two actors. So it's the most natural way when you have a function defined on the space of measure to associate to this function a function on a finite dimensional space Rd to the power n. Okay? And you may wonder what is the regularity of un if you know that u has a some regularity. So if u is continuous, it's obvious that un is continuous also. Okay. And what I'm going to talk is about derivatives, and I'll stop there. So assume that, so this is a proposition, and I do the proof tomorrow. And this proposition justifies once more the definition I gave. So assume that u has an intrinsic derivative. Okay, then un is C1. So un is defined now in a standard space. Okay, when n is large, capital N is large, it's a big Euclidean space. And the derivative of un respect to the ith variable. So I'm taking the gradient of un respect to the in the direction of the ith variable. So x is exactly like here. Okay. This is just the derivative, sorry. This is just the intrinsic derivative of u, evaluated, of course, at the empirical measure. And the extra variable is just x. And there is 1 over n input. Okay, so the 1 over n comes this 1 over n. Okay, and the xi come from the fact that you are taking the gradient respect to the x the ith variable. So as again, you see that this is the correct object, okay, to manipulate. So I'll do the proof of this tomorrow, or at least a sketch of the proof tomorrow. But it is a simple application of what we saw before. Okay, so I think it's time to stop. And tomorrow we will manipulate a little bit again this kind of derivative, and then we will talk about a little bit about mean field theory, and then about mean field control.
Thank you very much. We will post in the afternoon again this material on our webpage. Are there some questions from the audience? No? So then, thank you very much. And
please, for the audience, feel free to tell me if I go too fast or if I go too slow and so on. And don't hesitate to give me feedback, okay? Thanks a lot.